May it please the court, my name is Dan Abuhoff. I'm a lawyer with Debevoise & Plimpton representing SVIP or SV Investment Partners. And I just want to say I appreciate the opportunity to argue before this court this morning. The question in our case is whether a corporation with a substantial surplus can avoid its obligations set forth in the charter to redeem preferred shares out of legally available funds because the corporation says that payment of the redemption could jeopardize its ability to pay its debts as they come due and its ability to continue as a going concern. And we submit, SVIP, the preferred shareholder, that SVIP has a contractual right to have its shares redeemed, and it is therefore entitled to a judgment consistent with that contractual right, irrespective of ThoughtWorks' analysis of its ultimate ability to pay that judgment. Many things can happen with respect to that judgment. ThoughtWorks may negotiate the judgment. ThoughtWorks may negotiate other obligations. ThoughtWorks may sell part of its business. ThoughtWorks may file for bankruptcy. We can't control that. We can't stop them from doing that. But SVIP has a contractual right and is entitled to a judgment. The court below decided in ThoughtWorks' favor, and that decision, we maintain, was based on three errors of law. The first error of law has to do with the legal standard.
Just so I'm clear on the judgment, the amount of the judgment would be?
The amount of the judgment would be the lower of the amount that's owed for redemption, which was in the nature of $64, $65 million, and the surplus. And the reason I'm not giving you a definitive number on the surplus is the court did not go to that point of the analysis to determine what the surplus was, because the court determined that it was not going to give a judgment based on the surplus.
Well, how much are you asking for?
We, in our view, we put an expert testimony that the surplus was in excess of $70 million and was in excess of the $64 million obligation, and therefore we're looking for a judgment in the total of the entire $64 million. Okay. The Delaware statute, the DTCL, particularly sections 160 and 154, pursuant to those provisions, surplus constitutes funds legally available for the redemption of shares.
You said you're going to tell us about the three legal errors.
Sure.
This is the first one.
This is the first one. The three legal errors, I should be more clear. The three areas are, number one, what is the Delaware legal standard with respect to redemptions? Two is what deference ought to be accorded to the ThoughtWorks board. And three is a matter of contract interpretation. Our position is that, in fact, the court below made an error of law in interpreting what it viewed as the plain meaning of the contractual language, funds legally available. So we are at point one in terms of Delaware standard with respect to funds legally available. Again, it's sections 160 and 154 of the DGCL. There's no disagreement on this. The court below's analysis of this was very much in accord with our position in terms of how it discussed 160 and 154. And as a matter of fact, the court even engaged in a brief discussion of the purposes of 160 and 154, and this is the court below's opinion at A249, which is in the first volume. The court explained that Section 160's restrictions on redemption are intended to protect creditors. The statute seeks to accomplish this goal by prohibiting transactions that would redistribute to stockholders assets that were part of what 19th and early 20th century common law jurists deemed a permanent base of financing upon which creditors were presumed to rely when extending credit. As a practical matter, the court below said, the test operates roughly to prohibit distributions to stockholders that would render the company balance sheet insolvent, and instead of using insolvency as the cutoff, the line is drawn at the amount of the corporation's capital. So according to the court below, this is a quasi-insolvency standard adopted by the legislature for the purpose of addressing. Yes.
Is it correct,
yes,
that for this court to rule in your favor, we would have to conclude that the term funds legally available within the meaning of the preferred stock provision is equivalent to, that is the same as statutory surplus?
Yes, but let me just answer this this particular way. In other words, there is no other law that applies
I'm satisfied with a yes.
Okay, yes, the answer is yes.
Isn't the critical issue, therefore, whether or not the preferred stock provision is properly interpreted the way you contend it should be? I mean, doesn't the whole case rise or fall on the interpretation of the of that provision, which I think is your third claim of error, putting aside the other?
Well, to be perfectly fair, I think our case rises and falls on all three issues. I think we have to prevail on all three of the issues that I outlined at the outset, but we certainly have to prevail on that one, and that is, you are correct that we have to prevail on the issue that funds legally available ought to be interpreted as a reference to the statutory standard. And I could speak to that if you think that that's something you'd like to hear about right now. Certainly. The court below looked at the phrase funds legally available and broke it down into three different words, not as a phrase, what does funds legally available mean, but literally took one word at a time, which we think is not a felicitous way of interpreting the plain meaning. And in particular, the court came to the conclusion that funds legally available means funds available and legally available, or put another way, available funds that are available legally, sort of two prongs to it, which we think is just not what the phrase says. Now, how did the court go about getting to that conclusion? It looked at the three words. Number one, it started with the word funds. And if you look at what the court spoke about, the word funds, the court referenced dictionary definitions, in particular Black's Law Dictionary. This is at A252 or page 15 of the opinion. This is the definition the court referenced at length. This is Black's, quoted by the court below. In the plural, this word is a variety of slightly different meanings as follows: monies and much more, such as notes, bills, checks, drafts, stocks, and bonds, and in a broader meaning may include property of every kind. I won't read the whole thing. The last sentence says, sometimes used to refer to cash or cash and marketable securities. Immediately underneath that, the court then referenced lay dictionaries. And immediately underneath that, the court observed, or made the statement in conclusion on page 16 or A253, each of these definitions focuses on cash, cash equivalents, and other relatively liquid assets that could readily be used as a source of cash. On its face, and we're talking about on its face, even under the dictionary definitions, our view is that's not the case. That's not what that definition says. Or at the very least, it's ambiguous as to whether it's cash or something broader than that. In fact, the definition explicitly says it could be something broader than that. What the court did next is the court went to the other words, legally available, but took them out of order. So again, if you're focused on page 16, A253, the court just goes to available. It concludes that available means what we all think available means. It means on hand. So now you've got cash on hand, and then it goes back to the middle word, which is legally. This is what legally means legally, you know, not impeded by the law. And what do you get when you put all that together? You see in the bottom of 16, the phrase funds legally available therefore contemplates initially that there are funds in the sense of a readily available source of cash. The funds must both be available in the sense of general sense of accessible, obtainable, and present or ready for immediate use, and legally so, in the additional sense of accessible in conformity with and as permitted by law. And our view is that's just not correct.
Mr. Eberhoff, I suppose if one takes all the possible dictionary definitions, one could spin out any number of permutations and combinations to add up to a different number or meaning. This case went to trial.
That's right. That's right.
And therefore, each side had the opportunity to introduce into the record evidence of what the parties actually intended by this phrase,
that's
as
right,
opposed to what the dictionary meaning might be. What does the record show?
Well, what the record shows is this. The record shows, first of all, the court acknowledged that funds legally available has a colloquial meaning, generally understood to mean the Delaware statutory standard, and you see that in the court's opinion. I won't read it and you see it in our papers. The court, even during the argument.
I'm sorry, my question is, what does
what evidence
show about what okay. these two parties intended?
All right, there are several types of evidence. There is, number one, evidence in the terms of the agreement itself. If you look at the at 4A and if you look at 4D, which are the provisions we're talking about, they contribute to how this ought to be interpreted, whether it's a statutory standard or not. The evidence also included the, let me turn to this, exchange documented by the notes, what we call the Matt Rowe notes, and this would appear at A685 of the appendix. These are notes taken contemporaneous in the negotiations in the course of coming up with the transaction. And they are, in accordance with papers that we cite that were submitted by ThoughtWorks counsel, acknowledged to be an accurate reflection of comments made by ThoughtWorks. These are not SVIP's views. These are ThoughtWorks' views recorded contemporaneously by Matt Rowe, who worked for SVIP. And what that note says is mandatory redemption. We can pay as soon as we have the ability to pay, and it breaks it down into two units there. Quote, statutory surplus, end of quote, dash, legal ability to pay. That's what we're talking about here. That's contemporaneous notes of the party's conversation.
Was there testimony about that set of notes?
Yes. There is in evidence. The testimony is just that these are the notes. We have the testimony of ThoughtWorks that this
was
an accurate reflection of their view.
Did the notes testify about what he meant or she meant?
No, there was no testimony to help us interpret the phrase here, although we think the phrase is clear. Because underneath there, it then says cash over and above operating expenses, financial ability to pay, which seems to be a clear reference to the so-called working capital test.
Well, let's, putting that to one side,
yes,
the court made findings, and therefore there must have been evidence concerning the negotiation of the redemption provision. This was a provision that wasn't boilerplate. It was negotiated, isn't that correct?
That's right, it was negotiated.
And as the court found, the top of page 5 of the slip opinion, that's an appendix to your opening brief.
Yes.
Apparently, the first proposal, which is put forth by ThoughtWorks, was for redemption after 7 years with payments made in 12 equally, 12 quarterly installments.
Right.
And that was rejected. Your side countered with a redemption right after 4 years, and then, said, all right, well, we'll settle for 5. ThoughtWorks rejected that. And according to the opinion, the parties compromised on a redemption right after 5 years, subject both to the legal availability of funds and to a one-year working capital carve-out.
That's
now,
true.
Is it correct that the provision, the redemption provision upon which the two parties settled or compromised, marks the first appearance of this phrase, legally available funds?
Well, I think funds legally available is read into these children no matter what.
Let me ask you that.
I think funds legally available is a phrase that was in the draft all along. That's my understanding.
It was all along?
Yeah. I don't believe that was negotiated. That the parties
can you give us some page references? Because that's not what the opinion suggests. It suggests that the two initial proposals were for mandatory, unconditional redemption. And then after those were rejected, there was a settlement based on this concept of legally available funds. And that is to say that legally available funds was not a term that appeared until the end.
Well, I can look for reference, but I think what the negotiation was about was the working capital provision. And that was the focus of the proof here and even in the court below. And the reason the working capital provision is on point here, as opposed to funds legally available, which is read in whether it's in there or not, and I believe it was there from the outset. That was the heavily negotiated provision, because that was the provision by which ThoughtWorks was seeking to gain a grace period or an opportunity.
All I'm asking is whether the language that was before us now was in all of the proposals, that is, the first two that were rejected.
The funds legally available language.
What?
By the language, you mean the funds legally available language.
Correct.
Was in all proposals. I can't tell you what the
reports to that effect.
That's something I can check during the break. But I do think what is significant is this with respect to the parties' understanding at the time as to what they were negotiating. Negotiation was very much over the working capital provision. And the reason that is the case.
Are there record references to that?
The working capital provision references are largely in the prior opinion and the opinion by Vice Chancellor Lamb. There's a discussion there of the negotiations.
Okay, because the first, that opinion dealt with the working capital carve-out and whether it applied only in the first year.
That's right.
Or, in subsequent years. That's
yes.
Not before us.
No, it's not. But I think what the significance, the relevance of that is this, that the working capital provision was regarded in the negotiations as the provision by which the ThoughtWorks entity would gain relief in terms of having to meet the redemption obligation. If it found itself in a situation where it owed money under the redemption obligation but didn't have the cash to pay it, which is what ThoughtWorks is arguing for here, the parties did consider that possibility. And what they negotiated was a working capital provision to respond to that, and they negotiated hard over how long that working capital provision would extend. Would it just be 1 year, 2 years, indefinitely? And they negotiated 1 year. And that's what Lamb decided. So Lamb had the question before him as to what was the parties thinking? What was their understanding as to what would the situation be if ThoughtWorks found itself in a situation as it is now, where it has an obligation to redeem, but it doesn't have the cash resources? And what Lamb found was, well, they did negotiate a working capital provision for that purpose, and that extends only for 1 year. And he made further findings, which I think are relevant to this case also, that the parties so clearly understood that the obligation to pay the redemption would come due after that 1 year, irrespective of the cash available, that as they got to the point that they had to meet that redemption obligation, they had meetings and conversations in which they discussed measures that they would have to take to raise the cash, including the possibility of selling the company, and also talked about a possible negotiation.
Are we talking about at the time of negotiation, the time of the investment?
No, we're now talking at the time when the redemption was coming due.
Okay, well, I understand
the difference. I understand you're talking about evidence of contemporaneous exchange, and as I said, I will take a look at that during the break. But I mention this because Vice Chancellor Lamb found this relevant in his opinion.
Did Vice Chancellor Lamb find this redemption provision ambiguous?
Vice Chancellor Lamb did not focus on funds legally available.
Okay. Did Vice Chancellor Laster find this redemption provision ambiguous?
No.
So the notes, we don't even reach the notes if there is a plain meaning, and your argument has to focus on error in finding the plain meaning. Right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Our argument is that it's not plain meaning, that we ought to take a look at this extrinsic evidence, and that we submitted extrinsic evidence below on this subject, and this extrinsic evidence was not considered because the court below found that plain meaning controlled.
And why was that error?
Because we believe that's not the plain meaning of funds legally available. We believe that that it is capable of many different interpretations, many different meanings, and it's not clear on its face, it's ambiguous on its face. And the court's argument as to how the court got to the conclusion that it was plain on its face, in our view, is faulty and reveals, in fact, that you can't come to that conclusion on the basis of plain meaning.
As I look at the facts here, I wonder, why isn't funds legally available a defined term? If it's so critical to the relationship between the parties, why didn't the parties define it as a matter of contract?
Well, I think funds legally available is generally understood, and this, again, comes very clearly out of the court below, as generally understood to mean the Delaware GCO, that it means surplus. And you have a comment by Vice Chancellor Lamb in the decision below.
Well, let's test that.
Okay.
I think that you had indicated earlier that the requirement, that is the Section 160 requirement, that redemptions can only be out of surplus is a term that is necessarily mandated in any redemption regardless of how the redemption provision is couched. Is that a fair statement?
That's correct, yes.
So even if you're right that the term funds legally available means statutory surplus,
yes,
then it's really a complete redundancy, isn't it? That is, it's put there unnecessarily.
That's right. I think, and I don't think that's terribly unusual. I think you see in many corporate agreements, you see a reference to a statute.
It also could suggest quite the opposite, that the parties intended something quite different.
It could suggest that. There's no question about it. I mean, again, my argument is that this is ambiguous and that we ought to be looking at extrinsic evidence to see what the parties meant in this case. And I do agree that if the parties had taken the trouble of defining the term specifically in the agreement, we wouldn't have that kind of ambiguity. But they did not, and it is ambiguous. And I'm just really describing what the court below said. The court used the word colloquially. They said, the court below said that funds legally available is colloquially understood to mean surplus, the secondary meaning. The court below also, in the course of argument, said if you were to ask any Delaware practitioner, I don't know if the word was any, but prominent Delaware practitioners, and I think the court below went so far as to name names of Delaware practitioners, what the phrase funds legally available means, they will invariably say surplus. So it has a common understood secondary meaning, which is another reason that we do not accept the plain meaning interpretation that it means something different.
So, did you want to save the balance of your time? You only have about 3 minutes left.
Yes. Yes, I would. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kenneth Nackbar here on behalf of ThoughtWorks. As Justice Jacobs pointed out, this case comes to Your Honors after trial, after a decision on trial. We had a full record. We had 2 days of testimony. And I think the facts are important. SVIP is an investment fund. It purchased $26.6 million of preferred stock of ThoughtWorks in April of 2000. The record shows that it hoped to make a quick killing by an IPO within 12 to 24 months. That's what it was looking for. And so I think the exit strategy, the primary exit strategy, was an IPO. To be sure, the contract provision that brings us here today was in the contract, but it was not a primary focus. Now, as the court probably can recall, SVIP's timing probably could not have been worse. It invested at the height of the dot-com craze weeks after, the NASDAQ average peaked. As the trial court noted, within 1 year of the investment, NASDAQ was down 60% from its 2000 high. Within 3 years, NASDAQ lost nearly 80% of its value. Many, many investors were wiped out completely. SVIP was not. Now, as the court knows, the designations for the preferred stock, which SVIP purchased, had the provision that on the fifth anniversary of the closing date, April 2005, holders of the preferred stock could demand redemption of all of their shares out of funds for cash out of funds legally available, therefore. And that's the phrase that brings us here today. In 2005, recognizing that ThoughtWorks' future was not bright, SVIP demanded that its preferred stock be redeemed. If it thought ThoughtWorks had a terrific future, it would have held on to its preferred stock and ultimately converted it into common and prospered that way, but it chose not to. Litigation ensued about the working capital requirement, different issue than in this case. And the parties to that litigation and the court all recognized that funds legally available for redemption was a separate issue that was not before the court. Now, following that litigation, SVIP continued to press for redemption of its shares, and ThoughtWorks advised SVIP that it simply did not have and could not raise funds for such a redemption. The record is crystal clear and completely undisputed that ThoughtWorks today does not have and cannot raise $64 million to redeem SVIP's shares. Now, SVIP touts ThoughtWorks as a successful company in its brief. Success is at best a relative term. What the factual record before the court below shows is that ThoughtWorks has consistently underperformed its projections, both for revenue and profit. The business has been cyclical. Its operating margin from 2000 to 2008 averaged about 2.2%, never rose above 5%, and the company has had little, if any, income.
So let's go back to what we were talking about in the opinion where Vice Chancellor Laster says, if you asked most people what surplus meant, they would say funds legally available and vice versa. So if colloquially they were interchangeable, why wouldn't that be the understanding that's ascribed to those words in this agreement?
Well, I think there are two issues, and I think that colloquial, you know, what somebody says without thinking about it just off the cuff and what somebody puts in a contract are different things. But there are really two issues here. One is legally available funds the same as surplus? And I'll address that in a moment. And then the second issue that I think the court needs to address is if you decide that legally available funds and surplus mean the same thing, did the company have surplus? And our answer is they're not the same, but in all events, the company didn't have surplus. And I'll, in a moment, address both of those, if I may.
What are you going to do before that?
I just want to talk about a little bit more about a few of the facts because I think they're important.
Okay. As long as you know the court's interested in those two things you're going to get to.
Absolutely. I'm going to get to them very promptly. 2009, with its best ever revenue, ThoughtWorks total net income was just over $600,000. That's it in the record at A9032. While the face value of SVP's preferred stock, including accrued dividends, topped $60 million in 2008, SVIP itself wrote down its investment to $12 million. That's in the record at page B184. And it's important that ThoughtWorks is a service company. It has no hard assets. That's the opinion at page 11, and it's in the record at A1391, which is a testimonial record. Much like a law firm, its only real assets are its people. When they leave, the company has essentially nothing. As I said, ThoughtWorks does not have and has no ability to raise $64 million, or the record shows it doesn't have the ability to raise any funds to do a partial redemption. And that's not surprising because the board each quarter has looked at its cash, has looked at its needs, and has made redemptions in a process that the court below found was impeccable to pay out whatever it could pay out. So
does that mean that if ThoughtWorks had some liquid assets, not cash, but assets they could convert into cash? I realize that's changing the facts. We'll call it a hypothetical. But let's suppose they had liquid assets that could be converted into cash, that this case would come out differently?
Well, it depends. If they had $64 million of liquid assets that could be converted into cash and no liabilities, yes, the case would come out differently.
Well, isn't that fairly important then when we're talking about legally available funds? Because by definition, that would include liquid assets.
Right, and we had a trial on that, and we have an evidentiary record, and the company doesn't have those assets. If it did, we wouldn't be here. We would have paid them.
All of which gets me to the same question that I asked your honorable colleague, and that is there were three proposals that were over time put on the table regarding how this redemption would take place, if at all. The first two, at least according to the opinion of the Vice Chancellor, simply dealt with how, over what time period, that is, with nothing, with no other qualification. The third proposal, which is the one that's before us, has this language, legally available funds, or cash paid from legally available funds. Question number one, does the record show does the record show in any form whether the first two proposals use that language or language similar thereto?
I'm not sure that is in the record one way or the other. When Your Honor asked the question, I looked for it and didn't find it. It was probably, it may have been in evidence. The early drafts may have been in evidence in the trial court. I don't believe they're in the appendix before this court, which is why I wasn't able to find them to answer Your Honor's question.
One would think that that would be important if it was the subject of a finding and it dealt with the course of negotiation over the very term that's in litigation.
Right. Well, what we do know, here's what the record is, and the only parole evidence of the party's intent is the set of rather cryptic notes of the former SVIP employee, Matt Rowe, A685. Those notes refer to both the legal ability to pay and the financial ability to pay. They're both listed on separate lines of those notes. Now, SVIP says the, quote, obvious, that's the word in their brief, meaning of the notes is that financial ability to pay refers to the working capital test and that the only constraint, therefore, is that the company have surplus. That's the reply brief at page 17, but that's certainly not obvious to me from those notes. When I look at those notes, that's not what I see. Now,
are both sides speculating, or do we have testimony from the author of the notes?
We do have testimony. He wasn't brought to trial by SVIP, but we deposed him, and he had no recollection of either the notes, the meaning of the notes, or the negotiations. So, that's the record, imperfect as it is. That's what it is. But the contract. Let me sort of circle back to Justice Holland's question about legally available funds and whether it's the same as surplus. The contract that SVIP bargained for and received entitled it to cause preferred stock to be redeemed out of funds legally available, therefore. It does not say that SVIP can cause shares to be redeemed whenever ThoughtWorks has surplus. Would have been easy to say that, wasn't said. It does not say that SVIP can cause its shares to be redeemed whenever such a redemption would be permitted by Section 160 of the DGCL.
But what I want you really to focus on is, as I read your answer, that's predicated on the fact that everyone would know surplus and legally available funds have two different meanings. If they thought they were synonyms, then they thought when they put in legally available funds, they said surplus. Your answer just was, if they wanted to say surplus, they should have used the word surplus, which implies everybody knows it wasn't a synonym for legally available funds. So that's my question. How did everybody know they weren't synonyms?
I think it's the burden of SVIP to prove that everybody knew that they were synonyms. They're obviously different words, and legally available funds certainly implies, I think, at a minimum, that you have funds, for example.
Well, as you know, we issued an opinion in the last couple of weeks in Liberty Media where we said commonly understood terms ought to be given their commonly understood meaning. And so stated a different way, was legally available funds the common meaning? Was the common meaning understood to be surplus?
I think not, because what everybody does know is you can have funds but not have surplus, right? I can have, $30 million sitting in the bank with $50 million of debt.
Well, but you've said funds, and have you parsed that intentionally? Or when you say funds, are you saying legally available funds?
Well, I'm parsing it intentionally because I start off with the proposition that a phrase that says, I will redeem for cash out of legally available funds implies that there is some ability, some pot of property that can be reduced to cash, because they didn't want payment in property. They specifically bargained for payment in cash out of funds. So you've got to have funds, it seems to me. That's just common sense application of the words. And what the other side wants to do is smush it all together and say, you can't look at legally available and funds as separate. You put them all together, and of course they're the same as surplus. And there's a sort of abracadabra aspect to all of that in my mind.
Well, isn't there an abracadabra aspect on both sides? You made, I thought, the correct point that if the parties had agreed that legally available funds mean surplus, it would have been easy to put that into the agreement. Your position is that legally available funds means surplus plus cash plus the ability to hold back sufficient funds to make sure that the corporation will continue as a going concern. That's a lot of work that the term legally available funds has to do. If that was what the parties intended, it would have been just as easy to say that, would it not?
I think, again, respectfully not. And again, there are, for example, model provisions that the other side cites. And it's sort of odd because they say that, you know, everybody knows that surplus and legally available funds are the same. And then they say that this is standard language, and there's a model provision in the treatise by Bartlett that says mandatory redemption, quote, unless otherwise prevented by law. And then a similar model provision in the National Venture Capital Association, NVCA, materials that is similar. SVIP could have followed this model. It chose not to. And as this court noted in Kaiser Aluminum, for example, when there's a easily copied standard model available and parties depart from it, it's at least some evidence that the parties didn't agree to the result that would have been occasioned by the standard model.
So, do I understand you to be saying that you agree with opposing counsel that the term is ambiguous?
No, I don't think it is ambiguous. I think that if they wanted to say surplus, they could have said surplus. If they wanted to say whenever it's not prohibited by law, they could have said that. And those are standard language that is available and were available at the time as models. I think that legally available funds is not ambiguous. I think the court below got it exactly right. You have to have funds that are available, and it has to be legally permissible. Now, we'll get into, you know, what is legally permissible, but I don't think for this company...
Well, let me stop you just to get to a real basic level here. The other side is saying legally available funds means surplus, and that's what is commonly understood is the meaning. You're saying, no, legally available funds means something different. And, in fact, the way I can tell you it means something different is because if they wanted to say surplus, they could have said surplus. Okay. We're together so far?
Right.
Okay. So now the question is, what does legally available funds mean if it doesn't mean what it seems would naturally mean, which is surplus? And now you're telling me that even though it doesn't mean what you would expect it to mean, it's unambiguous?
Well, I don't expect it to mean surplus because, again, surplus, as pointed out in the treatises, is an accounting term. And you can't make a distribution, quote, out of surplus because you can't. It's an accounting convention. You could make a distribution out of cash, out of property, out of something tangible.
Well, Mr. Nackbar, if that term isn't ambiguous, then what were you doing trying this case for 2 days?
I think we were talking about whether the company had legally available funds.
There are two problems that I hope you'll address. One is that, and this really is a problem that both sides have, and that is for the court to accept their proffered meaning, you need to imply terms that are not explicitly stated. And in the case of your side, you need to imply a lot of terms that are not implicitly stated. Second problem is looking at this just from a purely business standpoint. The other side, if SVIC knew that after 5 years it would be able to redeem, but only to the extent the board determines that there's enough cash to assure that the company will be able to operate as a going concern, don't you think the response would be, that's a pig in a poke, I'm not going to buy that?
No, I don't know what a hypothetical negotiation would have said, but well, let's
that's why I'm asking about the real negotiation, but
right.
Nobody seems to have an answer.
But that's because it wasn't focused on. They were really focused on an IPO. But let's move on and let's talk about what would happen if legally available funds is the same as surplus, because there we have a factual finding of the court that I believe is entitled to deference. Even if surplus is the operative test, there's no evidence that ThoughtWorks has any significant amount of surplus. Now, under our law, surplus is assets minus liability minus stated capital. There is no evidence that ThoughtWorks has or ever had $64 million of surplus. In fact, plaintiff's expert, Ms. Stamm, never valued ThoughtWorks' assets. Instead, she elected to value ThoughtWorks as a going concern without considering whether or not it would remain a going concern in the event of a $64 million redemption. Now, the way she approached matters was by looking at ThoughtWorks' future cash flow based upon its projections. Nothing wrong with that up to that point. Now, the projections, as I noted, haven't been accurate in the past. It's fell short, both on revenue and operating profit. The record is sometimes on operating profit by 50% or more. That's in the record at A786 through 88.
But now, more in support of this argument you're now making, is there evidence in the record that says, even if the terms are synonymous, we don't have a surplus? Here's our analysis of where we are.
Yes, absolutely.
And what was your number?
Our number is zero. And the reason our number is zero is because each quarter we determine our surplus and we declare dividends, or redemptions, I'm sorry, equal to the amount of our surplus. And Professor Elson was our expert who went out and looked at surplus, and that was his determination.
Did the Vice Chancellor make a finding that it was zero?
Absolutely. He absolutely did. And so...
Now, this is also based in part, because I think you agreed earlier, legally available funds would include liquid assets. Is that right?
Yes. And that provided that you don't have liabilities. But,
right,
but
exactly.
Sure. In other words, if the company had, you know, securities, $50 million of securities, you know, $10 million of debt, it would have surplus, absolutely.
Right. So your point is you had nothing to sell.
Right. It's a service company. Its assets go down the elevators at night. And so what the court found is, and I'll just read the words of the court because they're better than I could say it. Their expert was Ms. Stamm. Stamm conceitedly did not consider the amount of funds ThoughtWorks could use for redemptions while still continuing as a going concern. She never considered how making an eight-figure redemption payment would affect ThoughtWorks' ability to operate and achieve the projections on which her analysis relied. She had no thoughts on how ThoughtWorks might raise the funds for such a redemption payment. It goes on. That's at page 26.
Mr. Nackbar, just to follow up on Justice Holland's question, you know, the one I was going to ask is your contention is that there is no surplus, there's no surplus because, regardless of whatever theoretical value can be ascribed to the assets, the actual liquidating value of those assets was minimal, or at least not sufficient to pay $64 million by way of redemption. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's broader than that, actually.
Okay.
What the company did is... And let me pause for a moment.
Let me put the question to you this way. What precisely does your side mean by surplus as it affects your second argument that there is no surplus? And secondly, what do we make of the fact that the Vice Chancellor agreed with your argument? Was he implicitly making a legal ruling that surplus within the meaning of Section 160 is what he found it to be in this case, or was he just making a fact-specific finding of surplus?
I think he was making a fact-specific finding. And so what what the factual record shows is that the company went out, it contacted 70 potential lenders, it fully canvassed the market, and the most that it could borrow against its assets to do a redemption was $23 million. The $4 million of redemptions had already been declared, so it was basically $19 million more, but only for a complete redemption. For a partial redemption, the company couldn't borrow any money at all. So that's the fact record. Now, the problem is that if you go out and let's say magically you had the funds, however you got them, and you paid $10 million tomorrow to SVIP, what would happen to this company? It wouldn't be able to meet its obligations, and it wouldn't be able to continue to operate as a going concern. And the important point there is that blows up the very discounted cash flow that Ms. Stamm or others would rely on, because the assets at that point aren't going to be generating cash. They're not going to be generating revenue, and the whole business collapses.
I think I understand your factual position. The question is, wasn't the vice chancellor really holding or implicitly holding that under Section 160, and the cases, glossing that, that a company can revalue its assets to create a surplus out of which a dividend or a redemption can be paid, but the ceiling for that revaluation has to be anchored to reality?
Yes,
that is what the company could actually sell those assets for and not some theoretical value.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, the other point is that Section 160 says that you can't do a repurchase of shares, quote, when the capital of the corporation is impaired or when such purchase or redemption would cause an impairment of the capital. And if we paid out $10 million, $20 million, $30 million, our capital would be impaired, because at that point our assets would be essentially valueless and we'd have liability. And that's the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Nickbrun.
On the last point, the court below did not find on a fact-specific basis that the corporation was revaluing its assets in a way that it was consistent with what it might sell the business for. The business isn't worth zero. Business is worth a lot more than zero. What the court was doing, it blessed the approach that was taken in the Freeborn memo that was followed by the ThoughtWorks board, which is that you can determine how much gets paid on a redemption on the basis of what's called a reconstituted balance sheet and also a cash flow analysis. It was not a standard, traditional, appropriate analysis of the value of the company. That value, based on DCF analysis, is in the tens of millions of dollars, perhaps 70, 80, perhaps 40, 50. We never got the chance to determine that.
What's the relationship between surplus, if you're computing surplus?
Yes.
And what you can get if you sell the entire business?
Surplus is a mechanical test, which is the difference between net assets and capital. Net assets is valued in the ways that we're all familiar with in valuation proceedings, based on DCF, based on other comparables or whatever. And both sides had different views as to what this was worth. I will say that both sides agreed as to what the projected earnings for these companies were out into the future. There's no dispute with respect to that. They both did a DCF, and on that basis, they came up with similar numbers. What happened was that their expert had discount factors based on it being a close corporation and the like, and we never got a chance to engage on that because the court didn't do it.
Let me ask you my question directly.
Yes.
Let's assume legally available funds means surplus.
Yes.
And we now conclude the company doesn't have the surplus to redeem this preferred stock.
Yes.
And your answer seems to be, well, sell the company.
How
do we get to that?
My answer is we're entitled to a judgment. And what happens after that judgment is I can't say. But we have a contract. We're entitled to a judgment. Again, that may work out in a number of different ways. I certainly don't take on faith a lot that I hear from ThoughtWorks. But on the other hand, based on the legal standard, were entitled to a judgment. I don't mean to cut this short, but I have to respond to what's been the mystery of this hearing, because it's been questioned more very often as to whether there's probative evidence, extrinsic evidence, with respect to the negotiations. We do have that chapter and verse. It is set forth in the Lamb opinion. If you look at 902 A second 753, and you line it up with the court below's opinion, when the court makes a reference, as Your Honor said, to the offering memorandum, it tracks right in this opinion. It speaks to the offering memorandum, and then it says that SVIP then prepared an initial draft of the charter that provided on the fifth anniversary of the closing date, each holder preferred stock shall be entitled to require the corporation redeemed for cash out of any funds legally available. That language is in the initial draft, which makes sense. You wouldn't put it in an offering memorandum. The form books all have legally available, funds legally available, for the purpose of a draft charter provision. What follows in the Lamb opinion is then the negotiations begin. And then you have, and there's some of this is referenced here, but it's in much more detail in the Lamb opinion, ThoughtWorks counter-proposed to revise the section to make quarterly payments. In other words, ThoughtWorks does not say, funds legally available, I guess we only pay when there's cash. They start negotiating hard, how much time do we have to pay, even though funds legally available is part of the background, part of the landscape.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.